Audible Studios presents Paradox Bound, a novel. Written by Peter Kleins. Performed by Ray Porter.
The First Time Around. 1. Eli Teague was 8.5 years old the first time he met Harry Pritchard. That morning, Eli's mom had tossed him out the door with a bag lunch and told him to find something interesting to do. It was summer, and she didn't want him inside watching cartoons or reading comics. She insisted a young boy needed fresh air and exercise. Eli insisted what he really needed was to know how Voltron was going to form and beat the Robeast when one of the 5 lion keys was missing, but he was told in no uncertain terms that he did not. He was upset in principle more than in fact. They didn't have cable, and there was only so much picture that television's rabbit ears could coax out of the air from the distant Boston stations. The bag lunch was a dry granola bar, a peanut butter sandwich on wheat bread with the crusts still on it, a green apple, and a thermos filled with cold water. No jelly because it had too much sugar. No ho-hos because they were nothing but sugar. Not even a juice box. Eli's mom had been on a health kick for a few months now, and he'd been forced to spend part of his hard-earned allowance on Pepsi and snack cakes down at Jackson's. It cut into his comic book budget, but his mom hadn't left him with much choice. He kicked around in the yard for a while, then rode his bike along the shoulder to Joshua's house to see if his best friend had any comics he hadn't read. Joshua had come down with a cold, though, and his mother wouldn't even let Eli come in. And Corey was still away at summer camp, so there wouldn't be any new comics at his house either. Eli rode his bike out past the old baseball field. He threw a few rocks at the stone wall that separated the outfield from the patch of woods behind the Catholic church, and then hiked out to throw a few more at the old rusted car he and his friends had discovered wedged between some trees one day. He went down to Jackson's and worked his way through the 3 wire racks of comics, even though he knew there wouldn't be any new ones until Wednesday, and the new issue of Amazing Spider-Man wasn't due for another 2 weeks anyway. Then old Mr. Jackson told him to buy something or get out, so Eli bought a Pepsi and a Chocodile and rode back to the baseball field to sit in the bleachers and eat his now slightly improved lunch. He weighed his options while he ate. Closer to the coast, there were tourist attractions like beaches and video game arcades and movie theaters. One of the towns to the south had a statue of the wrong soldier they'd gotten after the Civil War, while one to the north had a guardian scarecrow. Over in New Hampshire were all the malls with tons of stores and shops. None of these things were close enough to reach with his bike. Sanders didn't even have a library or even a school. Eli was bussed across the town line when school was in session. The old high school was used as a police station now. Not for the first time, Eli came to the inescapable conclusion that Sanders had to be the most boring town in the state of Maine, possibly the most boring town in New England. While he didn't have a lot of worldly experience and had traveled very little, if asked, he would be willing to bet a whole dollar Sanders was the most boring town in the entire United States of America. Eli finished his Chocodile and hid the evidence in a rust-flaked trash can next to the bleachers. It had been almost 3 hours since his mom had tossed him out, according to his calculator watch. He could probably sneak home and hide in his room until afternoon cartoons started. He took a big bite of apple, moved it around his mouth with his tongue to hide any scent of chocolate, then spit the mouthful of fruit into the can. The apple itself followed. He shoved the empty paper bag and full thermos into his backpack, swung his leg over his bike, and headed for home. A little ways away from his house, he saw the car on the side of the road. It was old and small, but still took up too much room on the shoulder for Eli to squeeze by on his bike. He was either going to have to come to a stop, drag his bike into the woods and around the car, or go into the street. Being in the street was forbidden, and he would never risk it this close to home where his mom might see. Still, Eli toyed with the idea of taking his bike onto the gray pavement anyway. It would only take a moment. His mom said he was too young, but he knew he was more than old enough. Just last month, well after his 8th birthday, he had to insist his Grammy stop getting him Duplo bricks and only get regular Lego from here on in. The old car had spindly wheels like Eli's bicycle, and a funny roof like an old wagon. The windows in the back were stretched out ovals. The whole thing was new jeans dark blue. A car like that didn't belong on the side of the road. It didn't belong on the road, period. Not in Sanders, for sure. Even for a town that still didn't have cable television, it was too old. Too old for anyone in town, even old Mr. Jackson, who was almost 50. And then, as he mashed his pedals backward and the bike crunched to a stop in the sand and rocks, Eli saw the older boy, who he would soon learn was named Harry. Harry stood next to the car, up on the car, on little platforms that ran along the bottom, and stretched out across the hood, yanking on some kind of lever. He wore one of the old-timey outfits, even older than the car, that people wore for 4th of July parades down in the Yorks or sometimes in Portsmouth. A blue coat, not as dark as the car, covered his body and swung back and forth with every movement. Eli stepped off his bike, dropped the kickstand, and took a few steps toward the old car.
"Hey," he said. "What you doing?"
Harry responded by tossing a big wrench over his shoulder. It clunked headfirst on the side of the road and tipped over into the gravel next to an old toolbox. Then the older boy hopped down, clutching something round and silver in his hand. A vest that matched the coat wrapped around the teen's torso, and his oversized off-white shirt poofed out around the vest's edges. He had long hair like a girl, but it was done up in a wide ponytail, like old-timey hair in schoolbook pictures. Eli found this outfit odd, although still not as odd as the car, because usually only adults wore the 4th of July costumes, or very young children, even younger than Eli, who felt quite old nowadays. On a guess, Harry was closer to 18 or 19, tall and slim, but not quite old enough to get the pinprick whiskers of grown men, smooth as a baby's bum, as Eli's mom liked to say.
"Kind of busy here," Harry said. "You should head on home."
Eli took another step forward. The car's front glass, the windshield, was all cracked and broken.
"Is something wrong with your car?"
The teenage boy nodded.
"Just out of fuel," he said. He gave the car an awkward pat. "We'll be on our way soon, hopefully."
Eli pointed back down the road behind him.
"There's a gas station in town," he said. "They can help."
Harry shook his head.
"No, thank you," he said. "I've only got a few minutes to get back on the road." "I could go get some gas for you," said Eli.
He waved his arm back at his bike, thrilled with the idea something even slightly interesting was happening right on his street.
"I'm really fast. I don't need gas," said the older boy. "My partner's off taking care of things."
He glanced over his shoulder, then past Eli and down the road. His face was slack, the look of someone waiting to get back a quiz they knew they didn't do well on.
"You should get out of here, child." "I live right over there," said Eli, pointing the other way. "It's okay." "It isn't. You should head home. Bad things are coming."
Eli glanced over his shoulder, but the road was empty, as far as he could see.
"What's your name?"
he asked, desperate to stretch out the encounter.
"I'm Harry," said the teenager. "Now go home."
He said the name in his head three times to make sure it stuck.
"Hello, Harry," he said. "I'm Eli."
The older boy nodded, his gaze still on the road. Then his eyes went wide and looked down at Eli. He squeaked out the name again like a high-pitched echo. Something about the look worried Eli.
"Yeah,"
he said cautiously, confirming his name. Harry dropped to his knees and grabbed Eli by the shoulders. As he did, his coat flared out, and Eli saw two leather gun holsters on his hips, like movie cowboys wore.
"Oh, my God," he said. "Look at you. You're so cute."
Eli knew he was not cute. He was, in fact, very mature and grown up. He no longer read Richie Rich or Hot Stuff and made sure to only select comics from either Marvel or DC. Harry was still holding him by the shoulders and still talking, babbling, really, about complications and Eli not being there and more demands for him to go home. It didn't make a lot of sense. It felt like Harry was rushing through stuff, the way adults would give quick answers when they didn't really want to explain things. One word stood out at the end of the older boy's speech, and Eli latched onto it.
"I have water,"
he said. Harry froze, his fingers tightened on Eli's shoulders.
"You what?"
"Water," said Eli.
"I've got some if you're thirsty."
He wiggled his arms until Harry let go, and then the pack slid down his back. He swung it around, unzipped it, and pulled out the bright red thermos. He'd stopped carrying the plastic Transformers lunchbox last year, but his mom still made him use the thermos. The picture of Optimus Prime was chipped and worn away by hundreds of washings. Harry's eyes got even wider. He snatched the thermos out of Eli's hands, tossed the cup lid aside, and unscrewed the top. He pushed his nose into it and sniffed hard. His brown-green eyes locked on Eli's as he hefted the thermos. Then he leapt off the ground and raced to the front of the car.
"It's better than nothing," he said.
Eli ran after him, clutching the backpack to his chest.
"What are you doing?"
Harry stretched across the hood. Near the center of the windshield sat a small opening that reminded Eli of the top of a jar. Harry carefully emptied the thermos into the tank, shaking the last few drops in, then resealed the cap with a few quick twists of his wrist. He tossed the thermos back to Eli and dashed around to the other side of the car. He reached in and flipped a few switches on the dashboard. There were a lot of switches, and some lights, and it all looked a bit more like a spaceship than a car. The car puttered to life.
"Hey," Eli cried out, "you said you were out of gas."
He gave Harry a well-practiced glare, the look of a child lied to by an older person.
"I said I was out of fuel," the older boy said, "and you gave me close to a pint. I just gave you water."
"Yes," he said.
"You're a lifesaver, if I haven't mentioned that yet."
He slid into the driver's seat and settled behind the wheel. Eli stared at the dashboard again. "Hey," someone yelled. Eli looked up and saw a shaggy man jogging toward the car. He had a Bond villain hat and wore a scratchy plaid jacket over a pale blue sweatshirt, even though it wasn't cold out. He had dark hair and a scraggly beard like people on TV who got lazy and didn't take care of themselves for a couple of days. His mom said it was how homeless people looked. He held a red gas can in his arms, a big square one like they sold down at the station.
"How'd you get it running?" the man asked.
"Quiet!" yelled Harry.
He ran back to meet the older man in front of the car.
"I couldn't get anything. The faucet was rusted solid," the man said.
He looked at Eli.
"Who's the..."
"Quiet,"
the older boy told him again. He knocked the gas can away from the homeless man and muttered some quiet words to him. The man stared at Eli's bike, then at Eli. Eli stared back. He wondered if the homeless man was Harry's older brother, or just some hitchhiker Harry was giving a ride to, or if he was going to try to take Eli's bike. Harry hit the man's arm.
"Now!"
The scruffy man got in the car. Harry slipped past Eli and raced around the car to slide behind the steering wheel. The homeless man held out an old-timey triangle hat, which Harry yanked onto his head.
"Hey,"
said the older boy. He snapped his fingers and pointed down at the pavement under Eli's shoes.
"Your mother doesn't want you in the street, yes?"
Eli glanced down. He'd followed Harry around to the driver's side without thinking.
"Get off the road and stay there,"
Harry told him.
"In fact, stay there for a few minutes after we go, just to be safe."
He pointed back to the sand and gravel shoulder where the bike stood. Eli nodded and looked back at his bike. Something moved on the edge of his vision, down the road. There was another car coming fast. He could hear its engine. Harry looked at the mirror mounted on the door.
"Time to go,"
he said.
"See you in a couple of years, Eli." "What?"
The old car lunged forward. Eli was showered in loose grit and dust as the wheels spun and hurled the vehicle up onto the road. The tires squealed and left thin black tracks against the gray pavement. He coughed twice, and the older boy's car was already past Eli's driveway and zooming away. He watched the car vanish down the road and around the far bend, where it stopped being Mill Road and became Abbott Drive. The sound of its engine faded, but even as it did, another sound grew. A growl, like an angry dinosaur or a werewolf or something else that should only be on the Channel 56 creature double feature. It was so loud it almost hurt. Eli stepped off the road. His shoes crunched in the gravel and the last swirls of dust settled around them. He breathed out and took new air into his lungs. The summer before, somewhat against his will, Eli had been enrolled in Pee Wee baseball and somehow ended up playing third base. It had been almost fun until the day Zeke the Freak, an oversized kid with a jaw like an ape, had sent a line drive right at third. Eli had been looking at something else, heard the crack of the bat, and turned to see the baseball hanging in the air a foot from his face. Each individual red stitch stuck in his memory, along with the curly letters that spelled out Wulings. and a scuff of dirt that crossed one of the stitch lines. Then the ball had struck him in the cheek and knocked out his last 3 baby teeth. Blood had flowed, and Eli had shrieked, and Zeke had cackled, and a year later he could still remember that moment of the ball hanging in the air. Eli turned around on the side of the road, and time froze. The black car was caught in mid-pounce, like it didn't drive so much as lunge forward along the strip of pavement. It seemed heavier in the front, and a thin line of silver ran along its side. The windows were short and rounded on the corners. Across the width of the car, the driver stared at Eli. His face was shadowed by a black hat, but there was enough sunlight to see his chin and nose and forehead glisten. His cheeks were pink. A little color to them, Eli's mom would say, and his eyebrows and mustache were dark lines on his face. His smile didn't show any teeth. Both of the man's eyes were closed, not blinking or winking. Closed. But his head was turned to point right at Eli. Past the man's face was a black gun. It was huge and blocky in the man's hand. He was in the process of putting it out his window. The man was driving and getting ready to shoot his gun and staring at Eli, all with his eyes closed. The moment passed. The black car rocketed past him. Dust and leaves whipped at Eli. He grabbed at his ears to block the roar, but the sound was already fading. He turned and caught a last glimpse of the car before it screeched around the distant bend. A sharp sound echoed back to Eli, a distant bang like fireworks. It happened again. The road went quiet. Dust settled down over the toolbox, the wrench, and the red plastic fuel can. He didn't think they were coming back for any of them. Eli's left leg was clammy. His jeans were wet. He didn't remember Harry or the homeless man spilling any water on him, but then the smell hit his nose.
"Oh, no,"
he whispered. He snatched up his backpack and held it to hide the stain. He looked back at his bicycle and thought of several different ways to get the bike home until he figured out an awkward one that would let him keep the backpack where it was. He stared down the road as he struggled home. He'd seen enough episodes of Knight Rider to know what had happened. The man in the black car had been shooting at Harry. A breeze carried the smell of urine to his nose again. Eli cringed with the thought of Zeke the Freak spotting him. Even Josh and Corey would laugh at him for wetting his pants. All other thoughts were pushed away, and Eli lumbered the last few dozen yards home with his bike and backpack. 2. Eli was 13 years old the second time he met Harry. He'd hit the ugly phase in every child's puberty where his body had to decide whether it would gain height or weight first. Eli's body had chosen the second option. He still hadn't reached 5 feet, but he'd passed 130 pounds last summer. He hadn't stepped on a scale since, despite his mother's assurances it would all even out in the end. Mr. Jackson let him go half an hour early that day because he'd sorted all the shelves and there was nothing to do. There was little chance of a last-minute rush this early in the season. Honestly, no matter what the season was, there was almost never a chance of a rush at any store in Sanders. If it wasn't for last-minute goat ropers, his Grammy's favorite term for tourists, who couldn't get a motel closer to the beach, Eli was pretty sure Sanders would have vanished like a fart in the wind long before he was born. He still had a decent chance to catch up with Corey and Josh, though. They'd stopped by Jackson's an hour earlier to grab some magazines, a few comics, and a six-pack of Mountain Dew. They were heading to hang out on the bleachers for a while, until it got dark. Josh hinted there may be girls there, too. Not girls like Robin, who was pretty much cool and one of the guys, but maybe someone like Nicole, who was already on the cheerleading squad as a high school freshman and wearing miniskirts and long socks to school at least once a week. Eli dragged his 10-speed out of the storeroom, pumped the pedals, and cut down behind the video emporium toward the founder's house. It was a roundabout way to get to the baseball field, but it beat going by Pizza Pub and the fire station. The little lawn between the two was Zeke Miller's favorite hangout, and Eli didn't feel like dealing with the local bully today. Really, there weren't any days he felt like dealing with Zeke. Eli's size made him an easy target, in many ways. The founders loomed in front of him. The building sprawled across the top of a small hill, its white paint yellowed with age and three or four of its windows cracked, but none actually broken. Eli could never decide if it looked more like a big mansion or a high-end hotel. He'd never seen anyone there to ask, and wouldn't have been interested enough to ask if he had. The founders just sat there, not quite at the center of town, getting older every year, and doing nothing else. There weren't even any good rumors about it. No suicides or hobo murders or angry ghosts or anything. Sanders was too boring to even have a plain old haunted house. Then, as if on cue, one of the windows burst with a crash of breaking glass. Eli clamped down on the brakes and his bike skidded to a halt. He heard the snickering laughter just a moment before the next rock pinged off his handlebars. He yanked his hands away as the laughter increased. "What are you looking at, Flea-Li?" Zeke bounced another rock on his fingertips, eager to send it flying. For every inch Eli hadn't grown over the past few years, Zeke had grown too. He was already being prepped for the football team, even though school rules said he couldn't play until next year. Zeke's best, probably only, friend, Dougie, was with him. They stood at the base of the Founder's House Hill in the gravel side road that led over to the baseball field. Their own bikes lay in the tall grass behind them. "Nothing, Zeke," Eli sighed. He glanced at the road and wondered if he could get away before catching a rock in the back of the head. Zeke's aim wasn't fantastic, but it was good enough. And Eli was an easy target. A wisp of smoke curled from Dougie's hand. Eli's eyes went to it. It wasn't the first time he'd seen a classmate with a cigarette, but it was still something that caught him off guard. It was foolish, but in his mind, smoking was something for college students and adults. Dougie saw his eyes move. The other boy's face hardened. "You're not going to rat us out, are you, Tubby?" Eli shook his head. If he hadn't stopped his bike, he'd have been past them and heading down the alley toward the baseball field. He probably would have been able to see Corey and Josh by now, and maybe Nicole. "Well," snapped Zeke. His free hand flexed open and closed, like it did whenever he got overexcited. Everybody called it his spaz fist. "Answer him. You going to rat us out or are you going to keep quiet?" "Yeah," Eli sighed. A grin spread across Zeke's broad jaw. "Yeah, you gonna keep quiet, or yeah, you gonna rat us out?" Eli's chest sagged, his belly flexed against the waistband of his jeans. He'd played this game with Zeke before, too many times, which is why it caught him off guard when the rules changed. The rock hit him just above his right eye on the brow. The blow echoed through his skull, and for a moment his neck and back and legs wobbled. He grabbed at the handlebars of the bike to steady himself, but it tilted with him. Zeke and Dougie snickered. "I think he's gonna cry," said the ape-jawed boy.
"Cry like a chubby little girl," Dougie said.
Eli's legs became solid again. The world stopped swaying. He flexed his knees and the bike straightened out between his legs. A few raindrops hit the back of his hand. Zeke's eyes went wide. "Shit," he muttered. He shifted his fingers and another lump of gravel dropped to the ground. Eli glanced up at the gray but cloudless sky. He looked down at his hand. The raindrops were dark red. He reached up to wipe his forehead. His eyebrow was sore and sticky. The fingers came back streaked with more red.
"Hey,"
said Zeke. He cleared his throat.
"Hey, Eli, you okay?"
Insults, punches, tripping kids in the hall between classes, shoving them around. These things weren't pleasant, but they were accepted. Drawing blood was not. Everyone knew there were rules, even to being a bully. Eli's body trembled. Fight or flight, his science teacher called it. Eli knew the feeling all too well.
"I'm sorry," said Zeke. I don't think it's as bad as it looks."
Eli put his foot on the pedal and pushed down. The bike rolled forward, carrying him across the front of Founder's House. The other pedal came up and he shoved it back down with his toes. Zeke took a few steps.
"Eli," he called out again.
Eli stood up on the pedals, pumping hard. Getting away was all that mattered, and he hated himself for running. He was halfway down the length of the Founder's House when he heard Zeke shout and another cackle from Dougie. A few minutes later, he stopped pumping the pedals, wiped his eyes, and looked around. He'd followed the road up the hill and around half of downtown, almost looping himself back to Main Street. He was on Cross Road, right between the two churches. The bright-colored Catholic church was next to him, and the dark Protestant one stood kitty-corner across the street. Cross Road wasn't named after the churches, but it was a handy coincidence. It also didn't cross anything else, ending at a T-intersection on either end. His eyelid was sticky, but the wetness on his hand wiped some of it clean. He rubbed his fingers on his jeans and left a dark stain only a mother would see. Some spit in his palm helped wipe off some more. Eli looked up at the Catholic church. Its doors were big and solid wood, but he knew there was a back door to the cellar that had a panel of glass in it. The sun was already near the trees, so he'd be able to get a good reflection and wipe more blood off his face. If he was lucky, he'd be able to pass it off as a random bike injury. High school was complicated enough for a freshman fat kid without his mother making phone calls and accusations.
Piss bucket!
The shout made him cringe. Zeke had decided a little blood wasn't anything to worry about after all and probably had a pocket full of stones. But the moment slipped away and Eli's breath eased. It hadn't been Zeke's voice. Or Dougie's. A clang of metal followed the shout. Eli scooted his bike forward past the line of shrubs to peer into the Protestant parking lot. In the back, half hidden in the shadows, was an old car. Eli saw a slim figure standing behind it, shaking a hand in the universal gesture for unexpected pain. Something rolled over in Eli's memories and stretched for a moment. He forgot his wounded eyebrow and Zeke and his mother. His foot pushed down and the bike rolled across the street. Another crank of the pedals carried him into the parking lot. He remembered seeing a film strip on cars like this in history class, one about Henry Ford and assembly line factories. This car was dark blue, with fenders that wrapped around the spoked wheels. The front seemed to be all chrome, and the round headlights were ringed with polished metal. A red plastic fuel can was strapped to the back, larger than the emergency ones the gas station sold. Panels of dark blue metal had been stacked on top of the hood. The older boy stood about 5'10" and thin. He had a soft face with green eyes and a small chin. His blonde hair curled on the sides and a loose ponytail with three ties in it slipped over his shoulder when he looked down at the engine. A collarless shirt hung on him with a blue vest draped over that. The teen took a few steps away from the car, held a piece of metal up in the sunlight, and gave Eli a view of baggy black pants. The sort of revolutionary period costume some people dressed up in for holiday parades, except these looked real. The fabric was heavier and the clothes looked worn in. A pair of cowboy belts crisscrossed over the boy's hips, or maybe it was one elaborate belt. A holster hung on each thigh just below the waist and gleaming black steel spilled out the top of each one. The older boy's eyes flitted from the square plate to Eli.
"Are you okay?"
he asked. His voice made the warm thing in Eli's memories stretch again.
"Were you in a fight?"
"Sort of," said Eli. He dropped the kickstand on his bike and took a few steps toward the car. The teenager lowered the metal plate and worked something long and white back and forth along the edge. Tiny bristles scoured the coarse surface.
"How do you sort of get in a fight?"
asked the older boy. He lifted the toothbrush from the plate and blew some dust away.
"Do I know you?"
The teenager eyed the metal square and pursed his lips like someone working up to an unpleasant kiss.
"My father always said it's rude to answer a question with a question. I'm Eli Teague."
The memories yawned and threw back the blankets. The scent of phantom urine tickled Eli's nose. He coughed it away.
"Is your name Harry?"
The older boy raised an eyebrow.
"I guess you do know me."
He tucked the toothbrush into his belt and hefted a bulky object from the passenger's seat. It looked like two cans stuck together.
"So how do you sort of get in a fight?" "He threw a rock at me," said Eli.
Harry cradled the football-sized thing in his arm.
"You didn't get out of the way. I wasn't ready. He usually punches me in the arm or pinches my belly."
The other boy grunted. Eli watched, then cleared his throat.
"What is that thing?" "This, young Master Teague," said Harry, "is one of the miracles of the 20th century.
He He lined up the piece of metal and pushed it down into the larger shape.
It's a modified Garrett carburetor. I had some of the plates replaced with superconductive material to improve the electrolysis rate, but impurities build up and they need to get polished every few thousand miles or so.
The plate clicked into place and Harry sealed the metal shape closed. Eli nodded in a slow, thoughtful way.
You have no idea what that means, do you?
Yeah, I do, Eli insisted.
No, you don't.
Harry crouched down on his side of the car.
It's okay. A few years ago, I didn't know what it all meant either.
Eli stepped closer and glanced at the exposed engine. Rather than leaning back toward the windshield, one whole side of the hood folded up and over the center line, becoming the stack of metal he'd seen from the other side. Harry leaned forward into the engine compartment, and Eli found himself looking along the engine and down the older teen's shirt. While Eli wasn't an experienced boy by any means, he'd been studying his female classmates' swelling bodies for some time now. The sight of cleavage in Harry's shirt made Eli's breath catch and his temperature flare. They weren't as big as some he'd seen in pictures and on videotapes, but those were definitely boobs. Boobs unhindered by a bra. As the older teen lowered the carburetor into position, there was even a quick flash of dark nipple.
"You're a girl,"
he squeaked, feeling both ashamed and excited. Harry looked up and followed his eyeline. She shook her head and pushed her shirt closed with her free hand.
"Don't be rude, Master Teague. We've only just met."
One finger came free of the shirt and twirled in the air. Eli stared at it for a moment, baffled. Then he turned around. He heard a rustle of cloth and a mutter.
"Okay," said Harry. "You can turn around."
He did. She turned her vest around backward. It sat on her like a high-necked apron, hiding any other glimpses from Eli's eyes.
"If you're going to stand here," she said, leaning back into the engine compartment, "you can at least earn that little show you just had. Grab a crescent wrench."
She waved at the passenger seat. Eli looked through the car and saw a battered toolbox. He jogged around the car, rooted through the tools, and came up with a rusted wrench that looked like it might have been last used during World War II. He dragged his thumb across it and the wrench unscrewed by a quarter inch.
"Any day now," said Harry. "Sorry."
He walked over and held up the wrench.
"Good."
She slid a bolt home through one of the carburetor's edges and twisted a washer and a nut over the end.
"Put it on the nut under this while I tighten this down."
Eli squeezed in and reached over the front fender. He got the wrench over the little hex and tightened it. The engine compartment smelled very clean.
"Okay," he said.
Harry's wrist whipped back and forth. Her own wrench grabbed the bolt, twisted it, let go, and grabbed it again. Eli felt the nut shift and tighten itself against the washer.
"Next one's a little harder,"
she told him. The bolt slid through on the other side of the pipe next to the engine itself. He stretched his arm around and realized he was pressed up against Harry. He could feel her body through the clothes between them. Eli got his wrench on the nut and tried very hard to think of all the issues of Amazing Spider-Man he needed to complete his collection. When Harry leaned forward and shifted her leg, rubbing it against his, he began listing members of the Teen Titans and the X-Men. Her wrist moved again, the nut and bolt snuggled together, and the carburetor settled into position. She held out her hand for the wrench.
"I can get the last ones myself."
"I can help," he said.
"Better if I do it myself," she said.
Eli handed over the wrench.
"Besides,"
she added,
"I think you might pass out if we bump hips again."
His cheeks heated up. He stepped back. A rattle of metal on metal echoed out of the engine compartment, and a minute later Harry straightened up. She tossed the wrenches into the box with a clang. Now that he knew what to look for, Eli could see her hips shift and the way her clothes hung on her. Not just a girl, but a grown-up woman.
"Why do you call yourself Harry?"
he asked.
"Are you hiding from someone?" "Harry's my name,"
she said, folding down the car's hood and rattling it into place.
"Short for Harriet."
"Oh," said Eli.
"I never liked Harriet. It always felt like a scratchy name, kind of harsh."
She lowered the other side of the hood and pointed at the hose coiled up on the side of the church.
"Does that work?"
He shrugged. Harry pulled the hose free and dragged it over to the car. She stepped up onto the running board and reached across the hood to unscrew the cap of the gas tank. The hose went in and she walked back to twist the spigot. Water spurted out around the end of the hose. A rushing noise came from the tank.
"What's that for?"
Eli asked.
"Just to top off," she said. "I've got over half a tank in the main, but my reserve's almost dry. I'd rather take the time now than wish I had when I'm getting close to a lead."
He blinked.
"But what's the water for?"
"It's fuel,"
she said. Eli frowned.
"Cars don't run on water,"
he said.
"That's stupid."
"I'd be careful tossing that word around, Master Teague,"
said Harry.
"You're the one who just lost a fight with a rock."
"Cars run on gas,"
he insisted, "not water.
The carburetor breaks water down into hydrogen and oxygen. The engine burns the hydrogen. The oxygen goes out the exhaust pipe."
She pulled the hose free and walked around to the back of the car, making a long puddle alongside it.
"Tap water's not the best. The impurities build up on the plates, like I told you before."
A few twists of her fingers got the cap off the red tank, and she shoved the end of the hose in deep.
"But if you really had a car that ran on water,"
said Eli,
"you'd be rich, a millionaire. Everybody would buy one."
Harry shrugged and rapped her knuckles on the red tank. It was a hollow sound.
"Are you rich?"
he asked. She shook her head.
"I believe I've got $40 to my name,"
she said, tugging off her backward vest.
"And 15 of that in Confederate bills."
"Why would you think I'm rich?"
"Because of how you dress,"
he said.
"Rich people can dress however they want because they've got money. They're not weird, they're eccentric."
She slid her arms through the vest and shrugged it over her shoulders.
"Big word for a young man. I read a lot."
Harry wrapped the tank again, and this time it was a dull thunk. She dragged the hose out and spun the cap back on. She pulled the gushing hose back to the church and shut it off.
"Well,"
she said, coiling it against the wall.
"It's been pleasant, Eli Teague, but the road beckons. I must be on my way."
"Where?"
"There's a little ghost town out in Arizona called Jerome,"
she said.
"I need to get out there before the copper mine closes so I can talk to a man about a dream."
Eli mulled this over.
"But if it's a ghost town,"
he said,
"doesn't that mean the mine's already closed?"
"Which,"
Harry said, walking back to the car,
"is why I need to get there before it closes."
She flipped a few switches on the dashboard. The engine started up, purring like a content cat. Harry walked back to the driver's side, pulled her coat off the seat back, and spun it onto her arms. It wrapped around her and hung down almost to her knees. Eli's heart pounded in his chest. He took a step toward the car as she settled into the seat.
"Why do you need to talk to a man about his dream?"
She looked at him.
"How did he ever think she was a boy?"
"It's not his dream I'm looking for,"
she explained.
"What's that mean?"
"It means goodbye, Master Teague."
He tried to think of something that might stop her. Instead, he blurted out,
"Will I ever see you again?"
Harry took her hands off the steering wheel.
"How adorable,"
she said. She pulled him in and pinched his cheek, the one away from his sticky eyebrow.
"It was nice talking with you."
She let him go, and he took a step back. Her feet shifted, and the car rolled backward away from the church. It curved around, pointing itself at the street, and started forward. The exhaust smelled fresh and clean.
"So will I see you again?"
he called out.
"It's a big country,"
Harry said.
"Anything's possible."
She gave him a wave as the car turned out of the parking lot and onto Cross Road. The purr of the engine became a low rumble, and the car raced away. By the time Eli ran across the parking lot to the street, the old car was gone. 3. Eli was 29, the third time he met Harry. He'd finally had his growth spurt and ended up very close to 6 feet tall, which had spread out his weight and almost made him skinny. Despite his mother's worries, he'd gone to college for computers and minored in history, two fields she couldn't see anyone making real money in. It turned out she was right, and he'd ended up living above a garage 2 streets from the house where he grew up. It was too hot in the summer and very cold in the winter. He drove 2 towns over every day to do IT work for the local Stahlbank branch and manage their network, which amounted to monotonous, busy work 9 days out of 10. The Tuesday evening they met started as a long overdue night with his friends. Neither of the bars in Sanders had a big screen TV, Corey's latest guideline for a good hangout. Plus, Josh had been living in downtown Dover for 3 months now, and compared to Sanders, it was a sprawling technological metropolis. So Corey and Robin picked up Eli. He sat in the back of their Honda and they sang the songs on the radio and met up with Josh at his new place. As they all walked down the sidewalk, Robin pulled her arm free from Corey's and pointed at a car across the street.
"What's that?"
she asked Eli. He glanced over. "That," he said, "is a 1978 Chrysler Newport, serious gas guzzler."
"You'll never stump him," said Corey.
"I will," she said. "Someday.
Not on cars."
They found a bar that met with Corey's approval and began to drink. Josh told them more stories of his miraculous life after Sanders and pushed them all to join him. Robin and Corey said no, as usual. They'd bought the Emporium, building and all, and lived in a spacious apartment above the video store.
"Why aren't you living here?" Josh asked Eli, turning from the couple. "You're heading this way for work every day anyway, right?"
Eli nodded and shrugged. His computer degree was worthless in Sanders. Every business in town was still working with cash registers and calculators. It was almost a 30-minute commute each way, but it was home.
"Just admit why you're not moving," Robin said. "Things are finally getting serious between you and Nicole."
Eli coughed. "That's definitely not it." "She's still trying to get that festival going?" asked Josh. "Tried and failed," said Eli. "Couldn't get anyone to back the idea of a film festival at a one-screen second-run theater. It just sounds too small town."
"It is small town," said Corey.
"So nothing between you still?"
said Robin. Eli shook his head.
"Nothing worth talking about."
"Damn it,"
she said.
"We need better friends. I want to go on a double date."
She mock glared at Josh.
"Don't look at me," he said. "The only guys worth dating around here are all straight."
He lifted one finger off his drink to point at Eli.
"Speaking of which, there's an apartment open in my building, two floors up. Even better view than my place."
Eli responded by ordering onion rings. Dover might have cable television, cell phone towers, and actual computers, but Sanders was home. He said so, and they all mocked him. They helped Eli eat his onion rings and then a plate of jalapeno poppers that Robin called bland, even though they made Josh gasp. Another round was ordered, but Corey had a ginger ale since he was driving. After finishing her drink, Robin pointed out women for Eli and men for Josh, but both of them laughed off her efforts. Josh and Robin risked some dangerous-looking shots the bartender offered them, but Eli chickened out. And then watches were checked, jobs were mentioned, and the night was over. They walked Josh back to his brick-building loft and exchanged hugs. Eli and Corey guided Robin back to the car, and they headed for home. 20 minutes later, the car shot past the plywood sign, welcoming them to Sanders and imploring them to enjoy their stay.
Home again," Corey sang.
"Watch out for Zeke," said Eli.
Corey lifted his foot, and the car slowed down. Just past the sign, they saw the patrol car sitting by the side of the road. The radar gun gleamed in the moonlight. Behind the wheel, Zeke Miller's head turned to watch them pass.
"And a perfect end to the night is narrowly avoided," Eli said.
"I only had one drink," said Corey.
"It's fine." "He'd make you take the breathalyzer test at least 5 times just to be sure."
"Yeah, he probably would."
"He's a jerk,"
muttered Robin without opening her eyes.
"You know he grabbed my boobs at graduation?"
"We all know, hon," said Corey.
"He's a jerk,"
she repeated, but quieter. Then she perked up in her seat.
"Oh, what's that one? Eli looks really old."
He straightened up in the back seat. The dark-colored car was almost invisible on the side of the road. Eli caught a quick glimpse of a jack holding up the passenger rear side, lit up by a flashlight beam and a red fuel can sitting on the ground behind the car.
"Is that a Model T?"
said Corey. Robin whacked him on the arm.
"He's supposed to get it."
"Model A, business coupe," Eli said. 1929, stop the car."
"What?" His head twisted back again. The old Ford had already vanished into the night behind them.
"Stop the car," he yelled.
"Jeez, man, calm down."
Corey pulled the Honda over. Eli reached around Robin to open the door and squeezed out.
"I'll see you later."
"What the hell's going on?"
"I'm sorry I tried to set you up with that woman at the bar,"
Robin said.
"It's okay," Eli told her. "I'm just going to go check on the car back there. See if they need any help."
Corey looked over his shoulder.
"I can back up. It's not that far."
Eli shook his head.
"Don't worry about it."
"How will you get home?"
asked Robin.
I'll walk. It's a nice night.
It's about 4 miles back to your place, said Corey with a wave down the road. Are you sure?
I'll be fine.
He patted the roof of the Honda. I'll give you a call tomorrow. Robin gave him an awkward hug through the window and he bumped knuckles with Corey. Then the Honda rolled back onto the road and sped away. Eli watched the taillights fade and wondered if he was doing something very stupid. He turned and walked back along the shoulder. His heart thumped against his ribs. Despite the early October air, he felt warm. A cloud of steam formed in front of him as he let out a deep breath and sucked in another one. An October night, but his skin tingled like Christmas morning when he was 8. The tall shape of the Model A appeared out of the night. The round eyes of the headlights stared at him, and beneath them, the 2 straight bars of the bumper made a flat mouth. A few more steps, and he could see the details of the radiator and the undercarriage. There were aftermarket suspension pieces by the wheel. The passenger door was open, and he could see someone moving beyond it. 2 steps to the left let him see around the door. Behind it stood a tall woman, about his age, dressed in dark corduroy pants and a blue frock coat. Her blonde hair was half hidden by a tricorn hat, but the loose ponytail still hung down her back. A wire-spoked wheel with a sagging tire lay on the ground near the foot of an old-fashioned jack that held up the back end of the car. The woman was trying to wrestle with the replacement tire while holding a flashlight under her arm. A long pole leaned against the Model A, right by its oval rear window. Eli took another step forward. Hello. The tire dropped, the woman lunged at the pole and whirled. It swung up, and Eli realized it was an old flintlock rifle. The weapon almost vanished in the flare of the flashlight. She held it under the barrel like a soldier or SWAT officer.
Consarn it, she said.
The flashlight beam went to his chest. The rifle continued down to the ground.
You just scared the life out of me.
I could say the same thing, he coughed. He'd pictured this moment a few hundred times and ways. None of them had begun with her shooting him in the head like a B-movie zombie. She raised the flashlight.
Wait a minute,
she said, studying his face.
Are you?
He smiled. The light dipped down again.
Eli Teague,
she said.
What a fine man you turned into.
It's good to see you too, Harry.
Twice in as many months,
she said, leaning the rifle back against the car.
Are you following me?
I don't think so.
It'd be quite impressive if you were.
Maybe a little, said Eli. For a while I wasn't sure you were real.
Why not?
Well, the last time we met I'd just suffered a head injury. It makes you question things. She snorted.
Be a gentleman and come help me with this wheel, Mr. Teague.
Eli gazed at her as she reached for the spare. The old clothes, the blonde hair, the hazel eyes.
You look almost exactly the same, he said. Just how I remember you.
It hasn't been that long for me.
He gestured at the low loops around her neck. I like your scarf.
I have to wear it,
Harry said. She waved her hand at the night.
You might not believe it, but this town's infested with lecherous little boys trying to take advantage of a young woman's virtue.
He bit his lip.
Sorry.
She pointed at the tire.
Lift it into place, please.
Eli heaved the old wheel up. It was heavier than modern cars had led him to expect. He worked it in place while she picked up an old lug wrench. She fitted the wrench over the first lug nut and spun it.
So, Mr. Teague,
she asked, finishing the nut.
What have you been up to? It's been, what, 12 years for you?
Almost 16.
He shrugged as best he could while holding the tire.
I don't know. Grew up. Went to school. Got a job.
Doing what?
I do IT work at a bank. Mostly it's just keeping their computer network up when one of them downloads a virus or something.
He saw her staring and cleared his throat. A computer's sort of an adding machine that runs on electricity. It can...
I know what a computer is, Mr. Teague.
She twisted another nut into position.
I'm not an idiot.
Sorry.
Married?
What? No.
Why not?
I'm only 29, he said.
29?
She echoed. She spun the third nut with her wrench.
So, not married. Why not?
I told you I'm only 29 and I'm not even seeing anyone right now.
He thought of Nicole as he said it. They'd been hooking up in the Sanders Cinema at least once a week for 3 months now. Usually on Thursdays when she stayed late to set up the new films.
Nicole was only the fourth person he'd had sex with, fifth if one used a generous definition of what counted as sex. But Eli had enough experience to know the difference between sex and love. It was convenient for both of them. There wasn't anything to it past that. Neither of them wanted more than that from each other.
My parents were married at 18,
Harry said, working on the last lug nut.
Well, father was 18, mother was 16.
That's young, said Eli.
It's old in most parts of the world, she said, even today. So, what are you waiting for?
You,
Eli said. The word popped out without any thought from him. It hung in the air for a moment before settling. Her eyebrows went up, but her eyes looked sad.
Me.
Eli scooped up the damaged tire and carried it to the back of the car. He pushed it onto the small arm that extended up over the rear bumper and stood there while Harry lowered the jack. The car settled on the ground. A minute later, she walked around and set the jack in the trunk. She went away, then came back with the toolbox. It joined the jack. She closed the trunk, cleared her throat.
I think you were confessing something, Mr. Teague.
His cheeks burned.
Yeah. Okay. I've been kind of obsessed. You appeared out of nowhere when I was a kid, and everything about you was just so cool.
Cool?
Neat. Interesting.
I see.
Like that. You know about computers, but you don't know what cool means. You dress like you're from the late 1700s, drive a classic Model A, and you've got $15 in Confederate bills.
Only three now, I'm afraid,
said Harry.
But the rest went to a good cause.
Who are you?
I told you.
She wiped her hands off on the frock coat.
I'm Harriet. My friends call me Harry.
Are you just going to drive off again?
It's what I do.
She walked back to the passenger side, leaned into the car, and flipped a pair of switches on the dash.
Stay,
said Eli.
Beg your pardon.
He nodded over his shoulder.
You could stay in town for a day or two before you take off again. We could... I don't know. I could show you around. I have a million questions I want to ask you.
He shook his head.
I studied history, cars, anything I could think of that might give me a hint who you are.
Tempting offer, Mr. Teague, very tempting.
She sighed and looked away.
Unfortunately, one that must be declined at this time.
Why?
Because I'm looking for something. And I'm not the only one looking. And I don't think the others can be convinced to take a few days off just because I might want to.
He rolled the words back and forth in his mind.
So this is some sort of contest?
More of a treasure hunt.
He set his hand on the passenger door.
Do you need help?
Inviting yourself along, are you?
No, he said. Maybe. I've just been hoping for years that you'd show up again. I don't want it to be over in less than half an hour.
She gazed at him for a moment. Her right hand came up, then settled back at her side.
I'm sorry,
she said.
I've already lost one partner, not again.
Ah, said Eli. I didn't know.
How could you?
She patted the car.
Anyway, I must be off. I've got to be in Boston on Friday.
What's in Boston?
Quincy Market. Someone's going to be there at noon selling information. I need to buy it.
For the treasure hunt, he said.
Something like that.
That you don't need help with.
Again, sorry.
And that you're carefully not telling me anything about. One side of her mouth twitched up, just for a second.
It's safer for you if you don't know.
Well, it shouldn't be too hard,
he said. If worse came to worst, you could probably walk to Boston in 3 days.
I don't have 3 days,
she said.
I've only got 2 hours.
You just said you've got until Friday.
I've got to be there on Friday, but I've only got 2 hours to get there.
You lost me.
Again, it's safer for you that way.
Harry reached into the car and flipped a few switches. The engine rumbled to life. She kicked at the dirt with her shoe.
I wish things could be different, Mr. Teague.
So do I, said Eli.
You seem very nice and clever, and you're very handsome. I think it could be pleasant getting to know you better.
She gestured at the purring Model A.
But this is a dangerous quest I'm on, and I won't risk anyone else's life.
Quest?
Harry stepped closer. She was a good height, just an inch or so shorter than him. Her hands settled against his chest. She leaned in close, her lips brushed his cheek, and warm air flowed across his ear.
Goodbye, Eli Teague.
She shoved him. He stumbled on the soft shoulder, grabbed at the air, and fell on his ass. He looked up, and she was already in the driver's seat, taking the wheel in her hands. Eli crawled back to his feet as the Model A rolled onto the pavement and made a tight turn, heading back out of Sanders. His stomach churned as the car pulled away, but he raised his hand to wave farewell. Harry waved back, and then she vanished into the night. 4. Eli had been back from lunch for an hour, trying to reconstruct the inventive new method one of the tellers had used to freeze half the bank's terminals. He yawned, still tired from a long walk home the night before, and very little sleep once he got there. He'd spent most of the night staring out the window at the road in front of his garage apartment, hoping to see the 1929 Model A business coupe drive by. Or stop. He readjusted himself after the yawn. 1.5 walls of the bank were all glass, and his cubicle had him with his back to the expansive window. Moving to block the afternoon sun from his monitor had become an unconscious habit over the years. The freeze probably wasn't that difficult. It just wasn't as interesting as Harry's warm breath on his ear, or the many possible things she could have done with 12 Confederate dollars that would count as a good cause. Then, a new shadow fell across Eli's cubicle and knocked him out of his memories. "Truss is in town," Bill hissed. Eli's eyes went wide and any lingering happy memories fled. What? Archibald Truss, never, ever referred to as Archie, owned Stahlbank. 80-something branches in the United States, 19 in Canada, more than 100 in Europe, and 3 in Japan. He also owned a movie studio, a toy manufacturer, and large percentages of several car and computer companies. He liked to travel around and check on his different holdings. Sometimes people knew he was coming, often they didn't. He dropped in on their branch twice in the 2.5 years Eli had worked there. Each time had resulted in someone being fired. The first time, it had been the old branch manager. "Sheila saw him having lunch over at that little bistro place," said Bill. "He was just getting his food when she saw him. And she's sure it was him." The assistant manager's head bobbed up and down, a shadow against the bank's big windows. "His caddy was out front." "Damn it." "Get it running," Bill said, pointing at the computer. "We can't have the network down if he stops by." "I can't just turn it on," said Eli, soaking up some of Bill's panic. "I'm still trying to figure out what happened." "Then just make it look like it's on. Get to it." Eli blinked the sunlight from his eyes and spent 15 panicked minutes scrolling through code before he spotted the loop. Simple, like he thought all along, a 1,000,000-to-1 mistake. A minute of typing undid the freeze and left a flag so he could find the snippet of bad code later. For now, he just wanted to have things working so he could have a sliver of job security. Someone cleared their throat behind him. He turned around, expecting to see Bill or maybe a customer who was looking for someone to talk about loans. Instead, he choked on the breath he'd taken in and took a moment to let it wheeze out. He used the moment to decide if he was expected to stand or stay seated.
"For Christ's sake," grumbled Truss.
The old man would have been well over 6 feet tall, but age had hunched his back and put his head even with his shoulders. His bushy eyebrows were the only hair on his skull, and his teeth were too perfect to go with his leathery lips. He looked like a vulture wearing dentures, if the vulture had rectangular glasses and a good tailor. His two personal assistants slash valets slash bodyguards flanked him. The one with the bright red chopped hair, Svetlana, had a dark suit and a tie that did not go well with her complexion. She stood 3 inches taller than Eli and at least 50 pounds heavier. Rumor was she'd been some kind of Russian bodybuilder before coming to work for Truss. The one everyone called Helena had sharp cheekbones and curly blonde hair she kept tied back in an almost topknot. Today she wore a pinstriped blazer with a gray turtleneck that showed her lean figure. Eli knew for a brief time people thought she might be a trophy wife, but the speculation had died quickly, probably because nobody liked the idea of Truss having sex with someone a third his age and even vaguely attractive. Much like their ambiguous job descriptions, Eli had never been clear if Svetlana and Helena were actual names, nicknames, or if they even knew this was how people referred to them. He thought Helena might be a reference to something, the way some people snickered about it, but he didn't know what. Truss glared at him over the rectangular glasses.
You're the computer guy, I take it?
Yes, sir, he said. After a moment, he added, Eli Teague, sir.
Are you one of those bootlickers who's going to say sir after every sentence, Teague?
Eli managed to bite off the correction forming in his mouth. No, he said. Not at all. The corners of the old billionaire's mouth moved up.
Bigger stones than your district manager, he muttered. Are we safe from the government?
Eli blinked. Sorry?
The government. My lawyers say they're looking into everyone's computers now. Can they get into this one?
Well, said Eli. I can't really say. I'm only in charge of this part of the network.
Blaming someone else?
No, sir, Mr. Truss, said Eli. I'm in charge of the in-house network, yeah, but that's still linked to the bank's larger international network. Asking me if it's secure is like putting me in charge of one window of your house and asking if the house is secure. The old man's bushy eyebrows tensed and relaxed.
Go on.
Eli fiddled with his hands for a moment, trying to build a better metaphor, and decided to stick with the one he had. I can tell you this window's closed and locked, he said. Or if I see or hear anyone in the house from where I'm standing. But that's about it. Security depends on knowing what state all the windows are in. He gestured at the wall of glass behind the old man. It only takes one to be open for someone to get in.
If they happen to look at the right window, said Truss.
Right, said Eli. Exactly. But there are so many windows that get opened and closed every day. Anyone who's determined could eventually get in. The only person who can answer your question is whoever's in charge of your whole computer network, and even they can only give you a best-case scenario. Truss crossed his arms.
You seem pretty sure of that, Teague.
I'm just a realist, said Eli. There's no such thing as a perfect system. They've all got flaws somewhere.
Even mine?
Eli had a quick debate in his mind about the scrap of code he'd found and whether he should mention it. Probably, he said, not pushing his luck. Truss stared at him like a snake hypnotizing a rodent.
Good to see there's someone here with a spine,
the old man muttered. He turned and shuffled away as abruptly as he'd appeared. The two women stepped out of his way, shot Eli a synchronized, icy stare, and followed their employer. Eli stood up to watch them go. Half a dozen other heads poked up from cubicles. Half of them watched the old man's progress. The others stared at Eli. Their eyes sparkled with curiosity. Was he about to clean out his cubicle? Was he their new boss? He shook his head and gave them what he hoped looked like a confident nod that said everything was going to be fine. The lights flickered twice, went out, and a loud clack echoed across the office. Every computer screen in sight went black. Eli cringed. He couldn't remember if he'd saved his flag with the line of bad code. After the encounter with Truss, he couldn't even remember where he'd found it. The customers and employees were already grumbling. The two women guided Mr. Truss toward the front door, keeping him hidden between them. They made it look like they were saving the president. A man stepped into their path, and Svetlana shoved him away with her thick forearm. Eli glanced over his shoulder and watched Truss head out to his car, a 1940 Cadillac 60 Special, the Imperial sedan model, in oxblood maroon, the kind of car movie stars got chauffeured around in during the glory days of Hollywood. Expensive then, even more expensive now. Rumor was the old man had one on each coast. He turned, dropped back into his chair, and listened for the hum of computers waking themselves back up. There wasn't much he could do for the next 10 minutes. The OS at the bank desperately needed an overhaul. Once it was up, assuming there weren't any more pressing issues, he'd try to dig up any transactions that might have been caught in the brownout and...
Hello?
Eli glanced over his shoulder as the shadow fell across him. He yelped, kicked at the floor, and rolled back in his chair to bump against the desk.
Jesus, Eli muttered. You scared the crap out of me.
The big man didn't move. He loomed in the cubicle entrance, taller and broader than the red-headed Amazon employed by Truss. The light from the windows behind him made him little more than a dark shadow in the bank. A void lurked beneath the brim of his fedora, with only a faint gleam along the edge of his cheeks to show anything solid was there. The man wore an old suit with lines that made Eli think of pictures of his grandfather from the 1950s. An immaculate outfit with perfect dry-cleaning creases in it. But at least half a century out of date, even to Eli's untrained eye.
Can I help you? He asked when the man didn't speak.
One of the arms came up. It held a long, thin notepad.
Are you? Asked the man, consulting the pad. Elias Teague?
Yeah, he said. Yeah, that's me. Can I help you with something?
The shadow checked his notebook again, then lifted the page to glance at the one below it. The movement seemed very rehearsed to Eli, part of a performance the man had given many times.
We're investigating a crime, the shadow said.
His other hand came up with a square that fell open to reveal a badge. With the light behind it, Eli just saw a flash of silver in the letters U and S before the man flipped it closed and dropped it into a coat pocket.
I spoke earlier with two of your friends, Cordell and Robin Ferber. They said the three of you were driving into town last night around 10:30 when you decided to get out and walk. Is that correct?
Eli took a slow, deep breath.
More or less.
May I ask why?
I felt like walking.
The government man said nothing.
They were going to drop me off, Eli explained, but my place is kind of out of the way for them, so I figured I'd walk.
The big man nodded slowly.
Have you noticed any unusual vehicles in the area lately?
Eli glanced past the man and caught a glimpse of Truss's blood-red Cadillac across the parking lot, rolling out onto the street.
What do you mean unusual?
Something out of the ordinary, said the man.
His face stayed very still while he spoke. His cheeks gleamed where the light hit them. He shifted the notebook pages again.
Classic. Or antique. An old Model A, for example.
Eli swallowed. The memories of shame and piss danced on the edge of his brain, but he couldn't focus on them. He felt the man's gaze on him.
You've seen it, said the man in the suit. Last night, perhaps?
Another memory joined the other two. Eli felt more drops of sweat on his back. One raced down, the other sank into his shirt.
What did she tell you?
Who?
Eli managed to squeak.
The woman. Harriet Pritchard. Did she tell you where she was going?
I don't know what you...
We know she's been to this town before. 15 years, 11 months ago. Did she contact you then as well?
The people in the front of the bank kept talking. Eli couldn't hear any voices near him. Someone opened one of the front doors, and the shifting pane of glass sent a shaft of sunlight across the bank and onto the man. The air wheezed out of Eli's lungs. The man wore a mask, one of the transparent Halloween masks people bought as cheap last-minute costumes. Two pink dots the size of quarters decorated the cheeks. The eyebrows and lashes were painted on, along with the lips. The molded plastic face showed a faint smile, almost a straight line. Behind the mask, the man's eyes were closed. The eye holes revealed two ovals of flesh behind them. The man leaned forward, aiming his face at Eli, but never opening his eyes. Eli swallowed again as the shaft of light swung away. The memory of raw childhood fear churned in his brain. The image of the lunging car and the man with the pistol filled his mind.
Did she contact you?
The man repeated. Eli pushed the memories away and straightened up in his chair.
What's this about?
The man straightened up and folded his notebook shut with one hand.
We're investigating a crime.
What crime?
The notebook followed the badge into a suit pocket.
I'm not at liberty to say.
In the shadows beneath the hat's brim, The eye holes of his mask looked like the empty sockets of a skull. Why are you questioning me? The man took a small step forward. He was in Eli's cubicle now.
We believe you may have information about the location of a dangerous fugitive.
His face didn't move enough when he spoke to shift the mask. This close, Eli could see the man's cheeks and square jaw adjust through the clear plastic, but his mouth didn't... His mouth. Eli swallowed a squeak. His heart raced. Beads of sweat drew lines under his shoulder blades and down his back. Smooth skin stretched behind the painted-on lines of the sculpted mask. The man had no lips, no mouth, no nostrils inside the transparent nose. No eyebrows or eyelashes hid beneath the ones drawn on the mask. Nothing but blank flesh. Wrinkles appeared on the man's brow between the clear mask and the fedora. He took another step and grabbed Eli by the throat. His finger and thumb stretched back, shrinking Eli's windpipe and pushing into the soft spots behind the jaw.
Where is she?
He growled. Eli could hear the faint muffle to his voice as if the man were talking through thick fabric or skin.
I don't know, he whispered. I don't. She drove off like she always does.
The empty sockets of the mask stared at him. The blank face leaned in close.
Where is she going to be?
Eli paused and the faceless man squeezed. Pain flared behind Eli's jaw and raced through his body. He sucked in air, but the crushing hand let only a few thin wisps down into his lungs. He beat at the man's arm, tried to throw himself out of the chair, but the dark man shoved him back without any effort.
Where?
Snapped the man.
Bust!
Said Eli. Fear pushed the sounds out of his mouth. The man relaxed his grip.
Boston?
Eli took a deep breath. Almost a third of it squeezed through his windpipe. He gave a weak nod.
Where in Boston?
She didn't say,
Eli lied.
She just said, Boston.
The faceless man leaned in even closer. Eli could see pores across the space where there should have been eyes.
When?
Whispered the man. Eli tried to look away and his gaze fell on the calendar pinned to the wall of his cubicle. It was a charity thing he'd bought to support a school's drama club or something. Kids a few years younger than him dressed in period New England clothes. He focused on Friday, then looked back at the man. The man's lack of face turned to the calendar.
Friday,
he said. The faceless man released Eli's throat and straightened up. He brushed a few wrinkles out of his vintage suit. One hand went up and adjusted his tie, then his mask. Eli filled his lungs. He could still hear voices up front, his co-workers grumbling about the computers. Bill answering questions and calming customers like a good assistant manager should. The man pulled a small phone from his pocket. It was black and glossy with chrome trim. He pressed a button and held it up to his head.
Hello,
he told the phone.
This is 15. Yes, my target has been located. Yes. Thank you.
The phone went back into his pocket.
What are you going to—
Do not leave town, said the faceless man. Do not attempt to contact the fugitive. If she attempts to contact you, report it immediately to your local law enforcement. It'll be transferred to us.
The mask stared at him.
There will be severe consequences if you violate any of these instructions. Thank you for your cooperation.
The man reached up, adjusted his tie again, and took two steps backward out of the cubicle. He turned his blank eye sockets to the group at the front of the bank, then swiveled around and took four long strides toward the emergency exit. Eli heard the clunk of the door's release bar. No alarm went off. He stood up and saw the faceless man lower himself into a large black car, a show car condition 1952 Hudson Hornet. It looked powerful and fast, standing still, like it was waiting to pounce. The Hornet started up with a growl that shook the bank's windows. It kicked into gear, swung around, and roared out of the parking lot. Brakes squealed as it cut off half a dozen cars. One man with a little girl bellowed after the car, but it was already on the road and gone. Eli needed to go to the bathroom. He wasn't sure if it was to piss or throw up, but either way he figured it was better to be somewhere without carpet when it happened. He marched to the teller's gate, slid his key card, and then ran. As it turned out, he just needed to piss, but he leaned forward and rested his forehead on the cold tile anyway. He washed up and looked at himself in the mirror. Sweat soaked his shirt. His eyes were wide. A faint bruise wrapped around his throat just above his collar. He looked weak. Eli pulled his tie loose and headed back to his cubicle. He grabbed his coat and his all-but-empty briefcase and walked over to Bill. The assistant manager was readjusting the blinds.
I need the next 2 days off, said Eli.
Why?
Something's come up. It's kind of an emergency.
What's going on?
I need to meet someone in Boston.
5. Eli woke up in a cheap hotel bed twice the size of his at home. The sheets were stiff and the pillow was overstuffed, but it felt luxurious. He felt pretty sure the trip to Boston was one of the dumbest things he'd ever done, so it was good to start the day on a positive. He checked out of the hotel by 8, and the woman at the desk suggested a parking garage on State Street. He moved his car, tried not to panic too much at the garage's day rates, and walked to Faneuil Hall. Eli's last time at Quincy Market had been almost 10 years ago, just before graduating high school. The all-pedestrian area, two broad walkways north and south of the main market building, had felt very exotic and European up against his small-town experiences. It still did. He stood and stared at the brick walkways and the colored awnings and the bubble-like street lamps as dozens of people moved around him. Most of the restaurants and shops wouldn't open for another hour, when the crowds would only get bigger. He walked down South Market, looped around the big plaza at the end with the Gap and American Eagle stores, then headed back along North Market. He looked up at Faneuil Hall as he walked past it and started down the south side again. A few people walked out with stacks of chairs and sandwich signs. More people drifted into the marketplace. Men, women, teenagers. A few men and women spread out blankets on the walkway that led to Commercial Street and displayed just enough wares to not be hassled for it. Eli watched every face he passed and studied every distant coat. A bright yellow and green booth, not much more than a pushcart, sat halfway down North Market. Its sign said, Trolley Tours. The woman inside was a few years younger than Eli, with short, colorful hair and horn-rimmed glasses. White earphones hung on each side of her head as she stared at something below the counter.
Hi, said Eli. This is probably a long shot, but could you help me out?
I could try, she replied without looking up, barely into her day and bored.
I'm looking for someone selling information.
She glanced up at him. Her mouth wrinkled.
You mean like a bookstore or something?
I don't think so. Maybe someone in another booth or a pushcart?
She shook her head, shrugged, and her gaze settled back to whatever was below the counter.
There's Newbery Comics and Teeny Billboards. I think the Best of Boston store has a couple of books, too.
I don't think it's books, he said. Her focus didn't shift back to him.
Sorry, that's all I've got.
Eli walked around the area again, then cut through the market itself. Another trolley stand sat between the Gap, some push carts, and three of the blanket vendors. The crowds thickened, making it harder for him to see anyone more than 20 or 30 feet away, the forest blocking his view of the trees. It also didn't help that there were a dozen or so people in period dress wandering around Faneuil Hall by 11 o'clock, various performers and reenactors who'd all come to the market for lunch. At least 4 of them wore blue frock coats. Eli leaped toward the first 2, but managed to stop himself before he did anything that earned him far too much attention. There were also a fair number of people in dark suits, many with hats. Hats seemed to be making a comeback. His pulse surged twice as he tried to remember if the faceless man had hair or not. Both times, a slight turn or shift of the head would reveal lips that moved or eyes that blinked. Eli kept watch, but felt pretty sure the faceless man would attract a lot of attention and wouldn't be able to sneak up on anyone. By 11:30, worry gnawed at him. It crossed his mind Harry might not even be wearing her colonial clothes. Sure, she'd worn them the times he'd met her before, but it hardly meant she wore them all the time. Would he recognize her in a leather jacket and skirt, or a UMass sweatshirt and jeans? What if her hair was down and loose, or piled up under a floppy hat? He brushed the thoughts aside. He'd know her, and she'd know him. The man at Teeny Billboards had nothing for him. The woman at Newbery Comics told him about the cool new Machine Man graphic novel, also available in digital for the tablet Eli didn't own. The Best of Boston store, it turned out, only had books during the holiday season, but the salesman seemed pretty sure he could order one for Eli and have it within 2 weeks. 11:40 became 11:45. Eli paced back and forth through the marketplace, past various shops selling coffee and Thai food and pastries and gourmet hot dogs. Another one of the reenactors passed him, a heavy man talking on a cell phone while he chewed through a bagel sandwich. His frock coat was the color of old leaves and rust. At 11:55, Eli stood at the far end of the marketplace, a hallway intersection between a Japanese restaurant and a pretzel shop. The crowd surged around him, all desperate to squeeze in as much lunchtime as possible. A shoulder bumped his, a handbag hit his hip. He stretched up on his toes and tried to see to the far end of the hall. A dozen shades of blue stood out, but none of them the one he was looking for. He needed to look outside. North or south? He only had time for one before noon. He picked south. Eli marched past Victoria's Secret and Urban Outfitters and a Samsonite store. His eyes flitted from person to person. Some met his gaze, some glared. None of them were Harry. The old Faneuil Hall building loomed ahead. Crowds gathered to watch two different street performers. A man played pop music on an electric blue violin. A woman passed five bowling pin clubs back and forth through the air in a whirl of color. Noon approached, slid past him, and vanished into the crowd. Eli ran across to the north side of the market and speedwalked through the crowd. He passed more shops and a Tex-Mex restaurant and the trolley tours booth and countless people in a variety of outfits. He ended at the plaza. His eyes flitted down to his watch. 12:07 p.m. His feet slogged across the red bricks and the crowd swirled around him. Tourists, college students, lawyers and bankers on lunch break. Eli looked at his watch again. 11 past now. He debated walking down South Market again. Maybe whatever transaction Harry had come for was still in progress. Maybe he just hadn't seen her on his last pass. Maybe she'd already finished her business and was on her way. Hey, he said to one of the blanket salesmen. The man had half a dozen paintings spread out on the grass, the kind of generic things that graced the Stallbank lobby and the hotel room Eli'd woken up in. Have you been watching the crowd? I've been trying to find someone. The man glared up from his current masterpiece. Paint covered his fingertips, and Eli realized the man wasn't using a brush.
Does it look like I've been watching the crowd?
I'm just asking. The man snorted and lowered his eyes back to his painting.
Who are you looking for? Called out a seasoned voice.
Man or woman?
A few yards away, between two benches, another salesman sat beneath a tree. A blue and gray baseball cap with a spider logo, smudged with years of use, shaded his eyes. A battered knapsack stretched behind him and a small panel of slatted wood, maybe twice the size of a help wanted sign, balanced beneath his hand. It reminded Eli of an old window shutter, and he wasn't entirely sure that it wasn't one. A dozen necklaces and bracelets hung on the shutter, each one tagged with a little slip of white card on a string. The blanket under the man had been folded into more of a thick pad, probably easier to scoop up, too, if one of the wandering policemen approached to give him a hard time.
Woman, said Eli. About my age, thin, blonde.
The salesman smiled.
Not much to go on.
He looked to be in his late 50s or early 60s, with a silver beard that was long but well managed. His limbs were thin without looking unhealthy. He wore five or six layers, starting with a Celtics t-shirt and building out to a black and white scarf that looked Middle Eastern to Eli's inexperienced eyes. The man could have been a veteran of the first Gulf War, maybe even the recent one. He looked like he'd been sitting there between the benches for a while.
Last time I saw her, Eli said, to the air as much as to the man,
She was wearing colonial clothes. The salesman grinned.
Reenactor. Woman after my own heart.
His fingers slipped between the necklaces and plucked at a few silver strands hanging on his board. His free hand gestured at the crowd.
Is she just wearing a cloak or a full dress and petticoat?
Eli pinballed between a desire not to be rude to the salesman, a mad urge to keep looking for Harry, and a swelling worry that he might be an idiot. He took one last look out at the crowd. Older women, younger women, Indian, black, Asian, white, tall and short, thin and heavy, blonde, brunette, auburn, black, one bright green, and another with nothing but dark stubble across her scalp. None of them were Harry. Actually, said Eli, turning back to the salesman, she wears a frock coat and a tricorn. The salesman blinked. The edges of his expression shifted just enough for Eli to register it.
What color?
Blue, said Eli. Classic colonial blue. He shook his head and gave the panel of jewelry a final, polite gaze. It all looks nice. Sorry to waste your time like this. The salesman's smile shifted a little more. The practiced, polite expression slipped away, the real one left in its place, twisted closer to a smirk.
You talking about Harry?
Air rushed through Eli's nose and into his chest.
What?
The old man's smirk spread.
You know her? Harry Pritchard. Is she here?
You just missed her. She blew through pretty quick.
Are you sure?
Pretty sure she was looking for me.
He held out a hand.
Theodoric Knickerbocker.
Eli took the hand automatically and shook it.
Sorry?
My name, the salesman said with a tug at the brim of his cap. For friends and the better class of acquaintances, it's just Theo. Knowing Harry bumps you right up.
Thanks.
He shifted on his feet. So you know where she's going? Theo pursed his lips and leaned toward Eli.
Maybe.
Eli waited.
Well?
What's it worth to you?
Seriously?
I'm a businessman, kid. I don't give anything away.
She's in danger.
So you say. Harry can take care of herself.
They stared at each other. Eli broke first.
How much are we talking about?
We all have our plans and secrets to keep, said the salesman. And Harry won't like it if I'm giving out clues to where she's going. Trust is worth something.
How much?
Let's say $100.
That's not much to give up someone's secrets and trust.
If it's not much, you shouldn't have any trouble paying it.
Eli thought of the parking lot fees again and sucked in his cheeks.
Fine,
Theo sighed.
How much cash do you have on you?
Sorry?
Cash. In your wallet and pockets, how much?
Eli did some quick math.
About $30, I think. I could get some more if there's an ATM around here somewhere.
Theo shook his head.
Look at the jewelry. Count to five. And then give me 25.
You're selling her out for $25?
I'm not selling her out. I'm just selling relevant information to a potential rival.
I'm not her rival. I'm trying to help her.
Well, in that case, Theo said, I don't feel bad about selling you the information.
Eli sighed, looked at the board, and pulled out his wallet. He only had 28, it turned out. He'd need to hit the cash machine no matter what. He thought of Harry's shrinking wad of Confederate currency.
Is this how much she paid?
Harry's a longtime customer and a friend. She gets special rates.
Eli plucked a handful of bills from his wallet and held them out. Theo extended two long fingers, clamped them across the bills, and folded the cash back into his palm. The hand vanished into his pocket, then reappeared with the fingers spread wide. He reached across to the board and his fingers danced through the array of necklaces and bracelets. He selected a bracelet, glanced up at Eli, then moved on to the next one. A quick twist of his wrist freed it, and he held it up.
Is this some sort of clue?
Asked Eli, taking the bracelet. Small gears of brass and steel dangled from it like charms.
Is it a signal for someone?
No, it's a cheap bracelet, said the salesman. If I don't give you something off the board, the cop over there is going to think I slipped you a dime bag or something. They'll leave street vendors alone if we don't give them a reason to bother us.
Oh.
You got a car?
Eli gestured toward the distant parking garage. A couple blocks away, yeah.
You should be able to catch her then. She's headed out to the left coast. Pasadena.
Eli sifted through the hundreds of city names in his head. Pasadena, California? Where they do the Rose Bowl?
That's the one.
On the other side of the country?
That's what all the maps say, yeah. She's going to be there on Wednesday next week, 4:32 in the afternoon.
Theo looked at his watch.
That's almost exactly 5 days from now, with the time change. After that, though,
he shrugged.
Who knows where she's headed from there?
So where in Pasadena is she going?
She'll be at the fork in the road.
Eli waited for more information. Could you maybe be a bit more specific?
What, like an address or something?
Yeah, or at least a cross street or something.
I don't know. Go to Pasadena and ask somebody.
Ask them where the fork in the road is?
Yeah, what am I, a tour guide?
Eli switched tactics. What's she looking for? Theo's smirk melted into a frown.
You've got no idea what's going on, do you? You're just chasing her because she smiled at you the right way.
What? His tongue stumbled against his teeth. No, no, no.
It's okay. You wouldn't be the first young man smitten with her, although I've never seen one go this far.
Smitten? The smirk returned.
Have the hots for her, dumbass.
Well, no. I mean, she's hot, yeah, but I just wanted to warn her.
Warn her?
Yeah, there's a guy after her. A creepy guy. The old man smirked and raised a brow.
At least you're honest.
What? No, not me. I mean, I'm just here to warn her about him. The man with...
Man with what?
You wouldn't believe me.
Kid, if we both trotted out all the things we'd seen that the other wouldn't believe, I'd bet $1 million I'd win by a wide margin. What did this guy have that got you so spooked?
Eli studied the man for a moment, then shrugged. It's not something he had. It's what he didn't have that freaked me out.
Okay, I'll bite. What didn't he have?
The last words slipped from the man's weathered lips and took some of his confidence with them. Realization and worry settled across his brows. An echo of the expression twisted in Eli's stomach. This is going to sound freaky and impossible, he said. But this guy didn't have
a face,
finished the old vendor. He glanced over at the finger painter.
He was wearing a plastic mask over a smooth face.
Eli stared at the old man, and then he spewed out 2 days' worth of fear and confusion. I saw him on Wednesday, but I saw him once before when I was a little kid. He drove past me on the road when I was on my bike. A whistle slipped out of Theo's lips.
Bet that gave you nightmares for a while.
Sort of. For a while, I think I convinced myself it wasn't real. Even after I met Harry again, the old salesman nodded.
You wouldn't be the first.
A shiver shook Eli, and it took him a moment to realize his body had just relaxed. Tension he didn't even know he'd been carrying slipped away and left him feeling free, reassured. Seeing him just brought back all these childhood memories. I think I almost wet my pants.
Again, Theo said with a smirk. You wouldn't be the first.
And his voice was just awful. I thought it was the mask, but then I realized it was his skin muffling. What is he? How can he talk with no mouth or breathe or see?
You heard his voice.
Theo shuddered.
How close were you?
He was right there in my cubicle with me, Eli said. He was asking me about Harry and standing closer to me than you are. He had me kind of blocked in my chair, and then he...
Wait, said Theo, holding up a hand. You talked to him?
Yeah.
An actual conversation.
The term threw Eli for a moment. He asked me about Harry, interrogated me, I guess. I didn't really tell him anything, but that's how I knew she was in trouble.
He talked to you,
Theo said, considering the words as they slid out of his throat. Talked to me, threatened me, choked me. The memory of strong fingers prickled the skin of Eli's neck. Theo dropped the board of jewelry onto the blanket. The pieces jangled against one another.
You stupid rookie,
he growled. He rolled off the blanket, grabbed its edges, and tossed them one across the other, folding it around the display board. The finger painter looked up from his masterpiece. What's wrong?
Think about it, kid,
Theo said. He looped a string of knotted shoelaces around the blanket and pulled it into a tight bundle.
He asked you about Harry, let you go, and you came running straight here. That sound like a smart move on your part? You ever seen a goddamn movie?
The cool air slipped into Eli's collar and down his back. I wanted to help.
You want to help?
Theo threw his knapsack over one shoulder and shoved the bundle under the other arm.
Get the hell away from me! Managed to stay under the radar for 40 years, and now you blaze a trail straight to my... God damn it.
His gaze slid from Eli's face to lock on something behind him. Eli turned. The faceless man stood halfway down the market, taller than most of the crowd. His hat added a few more inches even as it shadowed his blank skull from the midday sun. Eli could see a gleam of plastic wrapped across the space where the man's eyes should have been. No one reacted to the clear mask or the smooth skin beneath it. Theo's free hand grabbed Eli's wrist and yanked. The salesman ran past the finger painter, across the plaza, dragging Eli until the younger man's feet started to catch up. They pushed past shoppers and lunchgoers and random wanderers.
Move!
Snarled Theo.
We've got to get out of his range!
Hello, Mr. Knickerbocker, bellowed the faceless man. And Mr. Teague. If you could both please remain where you are, it would be appreciated. Don't attempt to escape.
Eli shook free of Theo's grip. Theo didn't hesitate, adjusting his bundles and diving between a man and woman in sharp overcoats. He didn't look back to see if Eli followed him. Eli followed him. He sidestepped quickly around the couple, pushing the man aside as gently as possible. Sorry, he called back over his shoulder. As his head turned, people shrieked behind him. The crowd scattered as the faceless man raised a huge pistol. It came up through the parting crowd like a hungry shark breaking the surface of the water. The faceless man stood in the open space, a black-suited statue, with one arm raised and aimed in Eli's direction.
Last warning, Mr. Knickerbocker.
Don't stop, kid!
Theo snarled back over his shoulder. His lurching gait carried him toward the wide plaza exit beneath the steel and glass roof.
Keep running! Get as far away from him as possible! As long as you're close, they'll be certain!
The gunshot echoed over the crowd across the plaza between the buildings. Theo's baseball cap flipped in the air. The old man dropped his blanket bundle and took three quick steps. He let the knapsack slide off his shoulder and took three more. Eli's momentum carried him past Theo, and he twisted around to urge him to leave the knapsack. But Theo's next step became a stagger. His knees sagged. His head dropped forward to display a thick, wet line of red spreading out across the salesman's scalp. Theo crumpled. His skull struck the bricks with a sound not unlike a bat connecting with a well-used Little League baseball. Blood drained out between the cobblestones, a gleaming red spider web around Theo's head. Eli stumbled three, four more steps, and paused. The faceless man strode forward. A few more shrieks and cries bounced in the air. Half the people scattered before him, the rest froze with expressions of horror or anticipation. Theo vanished behind a grove of legs as some shoppers pushed in for a better view.
Excuse me,
the faceless man called out. He slipped through the crowd without effort, the pistol down, his badge held high in his other hand. Eli pushed back into the crowd, away from Theo, away from the body. He shifted direction and skirted around the outer edge of the plaza, doubling back the way he'd come, back to where Theo's blanket had been spread out. He guessed he was 30 or 40 feet away when he risked a glance back.
Pardon me, ladies and gentlemen,
the faceless man called out.
Please stand aside.
The tall figure brushed past the lunchtime diners and shoppers and passers-by to stand by the fallen salesman. A few glanced up at the tall man, but then their eyes returned to the body.
Why didn't anyone react? A 6.5-foot tall man with no face stalked through the crowd and no one stared or screamed or recoiled.
The faceless man's shoulders hunched, and his arms seemed to tense. Even from 30 feet away, Eli could sense the annoyance wafting off the tall figure. The masked skull turned to the left, then to the right. Eli saw two police officers work their way through the crowd toward the faceless man, and a cool wave of relief washed over him. A woman and a younger man, they seemed to bob up and down through the crowd like swimmers in rough water. The distance between the police and the faceless man shrunk, and then the last few shoppers stepped away to create a space. The female officer stood near the faceless man. Her pistol was out, but she didn't seem to be threatening the broad-shouldered monster. She looked up at the plastic mask, at the thing in the faceless man's hand, and nodded three times. She turned to her partner and exchanged a few quick words. Then they both waved the crowds away from Theo's fallen body, clearing a space in the plaza. The female officer glanced back at the faceless man and gave a confirming nod.
"Ladies and gentlemen,"
the voice rolled out across the plaza, not amplified but clear and loud. It reminded him of the actors at the Algonquin Playhouse, booming out the lyrics of Buddy Holly without making it seem like shouting. Eli could still hear the soft, muffled edges on the words. The faceless man lifted his arm and displayed the object in his hand, the badge in its leather wallet.
"I know this has been disturbing for all of you, and I'm sorry you had to see this. Rest assured, this is a matter of national security. We're looking for a dangerous fugitive who may have spoken to this man in the past half hour or so."
People stared at the tall, blank-faced man in the suit. Some looked curious. A few squinted suspiciously at the raised hand with the badge, but still, no panic, no alarm.
"The fugitive is a woman," the faceless man told the crowd. "Approximately 30 years old, 5'10", blonde hair. She is most likely dressed in a blue coat, like one of the colonial reenactors here, possibly wearing a tricorn hat."
A few people on the edges of the crowd looked around. They eyed the distant reenactors. Some of them pointed. The police scanned the dozens of faces in front of them.
"She may also have an accomplice," continued the faceless man. "Male, 29, 5'11", brown hair. They were both supposed to meet with this man, a collaborator."
Without turning his blank features, he gestured at the body splayed on the bricks behind him. A cold chill crawled over Eli's skull and slipped down his back. A level of panic he hadn't felt since childhood tingled in his chest and fingertips. He took a step back and let his shoulders slump a little. He let his chin settle low and hunched a little more. His left foot slid back again and he dragged the right one after it. He took three more steps backward. Most of the people in the crowd still looked at the faceless man, but a few on the edges glanced around. A few yards away, the finger painter scanned the crowd, his head swinging back and forth. Eli pulled his sweatshirt hood up, realized it made him look like every guilty person since the creation of hoodie sweatshirts, and pushed it back down. He turned to his left, parallel to the crowd, and then let his path curve around, away from the faceless man, and toward the streets outside Quincy Market.
"Hello, Mr. Teague," boomed the voice. "Good to see you again."
Eli wasn't stupid. It was a trick to make him turn and look, to get him to reveal himself. He kept his shoulders slumped, his head down, and continued toward the road. He passed a few people heading the other way into the plaza. They looked ahead at the crowd, then glanced behind them. Two or three of them glanced at Eli. He reached the corner, stopped, and stretched. He filled his tight chest with air and tried very hard to look like a man with all the time in the world. A man definitely not trying to slip away from a crowd that might be turning into a mob. He looked to his right, down the street, and turned a little more to look over his shoulder at the plaza. The faceless man had waded through the crowd. The blank sockets behind his plastic mask were aimed at Eli. He took another step forward and raised his arm. Eli ran. 6. What little Eli knew about being on the run was from half-remembered movies and less-remembered childhood novels about
teen investigators. He didn't think either source could be thought of as reliable. He also didn't have much else to go on. He ran for 2 blocks, then slowed down and tried to blend into the crowd. He shrugged his dark pea coat off and pulled the sweatshirt hood back up. He thought about tossing the coat, but decided to leave it draped over one arm. He stopped to stare at a flyer taped to a phone pole, something about a band he didn't know playing at a bar he'd never heard of, and used it as a chance to look back the way he'd come. No one pointed or yelled, no police or enthusiastic citizens or faceless men. A good number of pedestrians strode through his field of view, but none of them seemed interested in him, or anyone else for that matter. They focused on newspapers, phones, balancing their bags, and just getting to 100 different destinations. Eli turned and kept walking away from Quincy Market, and away from his car, too. It sat in the garage north of the market, probably for the best. There might be someone watching it, or maybe the faceless man could track it somehow. So, thought Eli, what now? Finding out the secrets of the alluring Harry Pritchard and her mysterious life had lost a lot of appeal in the past half hour or so. A few seeds of fascination still tickled his mind, but a much larger part of his brain screamed, "Not worth it!" Truth was, he'd known her for maybe 2 hours altogether. He knew nothing about her, good or bad. He could go home. Just go back to his car, and if he didn't get arrested right there, drive home to safe, boring Sanders and continue with his safe, boring life. Again, assuming he wasn't arrested and hauled off to some prison or stockade or something. Maybe the faceless man would leave him alone. He had twice before. If Eli made it clear he didn't know anything and didn't want to know anything, maybe the blank-faced man would let him go home. But the faceless man had shot Theo Knickerbocker in the head, right in front of a few hundred people. No questions, no hesitations, one warning, bang. A man with no face and a Halloween mask had shot someone dead in the middle of a shopping mall, and no one had said a thing. The gunshot had caused a few screams and cries, but then nothing. Going home didn't seem like a great option. Just like finding system bugs, process of elimination, he couldn't stay here, he couldn't go back. Stupid as it sounded, he had to go forward. Eli walked 2 more blocks, coming to this decision. As his chain of reasoning came to its end, so did the sidewalk. And across the street from him sat the bus station. The hotel room had eaten a good chunk of his dwindling bank balance, and a ticket to California would eat up a lot of what remained. He knew, better than most, that bank withdrawals could be tracked, but didn't see much choice. After a bit of internal debate, he got all the money he could from the bus station's ATM, flinching at the fee, and then paid cash for the ticket. It wasn't much of a screen, but it might slow the police down a little bit, or whoever else might be following him. The route cross-country involved a few transfers, but it would put Eli in Pasadena 5 hours before Harry's scheduled appearance. By sheer luck, the bus he needed boarded in just 40 minutes. He spent the time walking from one end of the terminal to the other, watching every road and door. It probably made him look suspicious, but his nerves jumped too much for him to stand still. On the 5th time around the station, Eli saw the faceless man standing on a distant street corner. He ducked behind the bulk of a vending machine before the mask turned to aim in his direction. When he peered around a few moments later, he saw the faceless man's back. A woman's voice with a thin Boston accent called boarding for his bus, 10 minutes early. He backed away from the corner and followed the signs to his terminal. He stood in line next to the big blue bus as people slung duffel bags and rolling suitcases into the luggage compartment. He glanced over his shoulder 3 times while the line inched forward, showed his ticket to a bored man with Coke bottle glasses, then climbed up the narrow stairs. The inside of the bus looked more like a train, or what trains looked like in the movies Eli had seen over the years. The seats were set up in groups of 4, facing each other 2 by 2. A small staircase led upstairs. The bus had an upstairs. He found a seat near the window and hunched down low. He should have bought a hat at the bus station's little store, or a pair of sunglasses.
He shifted the hood of his sweatshirt, hoping it settled in a position that hid his face without looking like it was hiding his face. An older man in a down coat flopped into the seat across from Eli. His skin had the color and texture of a vintage leather jacket. At least 30 years of cigarettes wafted from the man's pores. One rested behind his ear. Wrinkles along its length showed where it had been bent and straightened. Through the bus window, Eli saw a man in a dark suit step out of the station. He stood 50 feet down the walkway and held no luggage. One of the hanging signs blocked the man's face. His body turned toward Eli's bus, away, then back. A woman sat down in the aisle seat across from Eli. The cigarette man raised a brow and a wave of perfume rolled up to sting Eli's eyes. He blinked away the smell of baby powder and chemical roses. The man in the suit took a few steps toward Eli's bus. Was the suit black or very dark blue? Eli tried to get a better sense of its color and style, but the man was too far away, and the bus window, while not filthy, was far from clean. A hiss came from the front of the bus. The people around him rumbled. Eli looked forward and saw a few people in the aisle adjusting luggage in the upper racks. The bus trembled. A college-age kid chose between Eli and the cigarette man and sat down next to Eli. The doors closed. Everyone had boarded, and the bus was pulling out. The floor trembled, and Eli's seat gave a small lurch. The station outside seemed to slide away. The man in the suit slid away with it. He took a few more steps toward Eli's bus, trying to keep up. Eli glimpsed a glossy plastic chin and painted lips, and then the faceless man vanished as another bus came between them. The bus swung back in a smooth arc. After a moment, Eli was looking at the back of the row of buses, with narrow glimpses of the terminal between them. Then the seat lurched again, and they moved forward. Eli was California bound. 7. Four buses, a train, another two buses, and 5 days later, Eli stepped onto the sidewalk in Pasadena in desperate need of a shower, some clean clothes, and at least one solid meal. The city reminded him a bit of Dover, a good-sized town with parts of a city squeezed in here and there. There were 3- and 4-story buildings of brick and concrete across the street from steel and glass storefronts. The weight of his pea coat pressed sweat out of his chest and back. After half an hour, he shrugged out of it and slung it over his arm. The sun felt oppressively bright and hot, and once again he found himself wishing he'd bought sunglasses in Boston. Half the people on the street either had a phone pressed to their head or held in front of them like a microphone. Most of the others wore tiny headphones. 2 wore massive retro-looking sets that covered their ears. Eli tried to catch the 2 or 3 people with open ears, but they slipped away into the crowd or into buildings. After 20 minutes of trying to catch a pedestrian, Eli switched tactics. He looked around, spotted a chain drugstore, and walked in. Less than a dozen customers, if he counted right, despite the noon hour, and 1 cashier on duty. A paunchy security guard glanced at the heavy peacoat over his arm, then went back to staring into space. Eli found a granola bar and a Mountain Dew, 4 of his remaining $32 gone at convenience store prices, and waited until the 2 customers in line had concluded their transactions. The cashier looked tired or bored, possibly a mix of the 2. Eli put her at 15 or 20 years older than himself, not quite his mother's age. A few strands of silver highlighted the woman's hair. Her name tag had a dark, sticky spot in the shape of a T, followed by ORI. She took Eli's meager lunch, waved it over a price scanner, and asked if that would be all. Actually, said Eli, I don't suppose you know where the fork in the road is? The woman blinked and looked at him for the first time.
Sorry?
Her voice had an accent he couldn't place, almost turning her S's into Z's. The fork in the road, I'm supposed to meet someone there in... He glanced at his watch. In about an hour, but I'm not sure where it is. She stared at him for a moment. Then she blinked twice.
Oh, she said. The fork.
Yeah, I guess.
It's easy.
She waved her hand at the door.
Go down Colorado,
she said, pointing with one finger.
About 6 blocks and turn left on Pasadena Avenue. Then just go straight until you see it, maybe 2 miles altogether.
Eli smiled. Thank you.
Where are you from?
What?
Your accent, where are you from?
Maine, he said. A little town called Sanders. You haven't heard of it?
Near Stephen King?
Not really, no. The cashier shrugged. She gave him his change and pushed his food across the counter without offering him a bag. Her eyes slid to the person behind him. Eli munched the granola bar as he walked down Colorado. It was a big, wide street, several lanes across, and his gaze kept sliding up the taller buildings to the sky. At Pasadena, he tossed the wrapper in a trash can and cracked open the Mountain Dew. Traffic on Pasadena Avenue all came at him one way. The road started out with businesses, but quickly became more residential. The houses had a very cinematic feel, as if he'd seen the street a dozen times in movies or television shows. Eli kept expecting celebrities to step through apartment doors or out of parked cars. The woman across the street could have been a celebrity. Her outfit showed either determined eccentricity or a poor sense of disguise. She wore a long trench coat and a swollen hat of brown leather, something between a large bonnet and a plush muffin, with a large brass button just over her forehead. What he'd first mistaken for an odd, heavy collar on her sweater had glinted in the sun and revealed itself to be a huge pair of sunglasses, or maybe goggles. She looked around with quick, nervous glances, waiting to get recognized, and locked eyes with Eli for a moment as they approached each other. She managed a weak smile when he didn't react, as if they'd shared a secret. He passed more apartments, a big complex that identified itself as the Ronald McDonald House, something he'd definitely seen on television, and a house that declared itself to be an English tea garden before he reached a wide open space. The narrow block between two roads formed a small park with some grass, spiky bushes, and a few trees that included a huge, thick palm. A gravelly path led to an oval of sand and some kind of marker at the park's center, a narrow pillar of aluminum, or maybe steel, that stood 20 feet tall. Another minute of walking carried him past the park to an intersection. On the other side of the block, the road mirrored his, a one-way street running the other way. The little park was a triangle, not much more than an oversized traffic island formed by the two streets coming together to form a single road. No, not where they came together, where they split. The fork seemed normal. Houses on either side, a small apartment building at one end. A man worked a lawnmower across a distant lawn. Eli wasn't sure what Harry would be looking for here in just 20 minutes. Assuming he was even at the right intersection, Theo had made a blanket assumption everyone would know which fork he was referring to. The cashier seemed pretty sure, granted. Could it be possible the roads didn't split like this anywhere else in the city? What if it wasn't related to street layout? What if the fork in the road was the name of some trendy bar or club hidden in one of the nearby buildings? Those supposedly covered Southern California, and it'd make much more sense as a meeting place. Hell, it could be a cutlery store or travel agency or just a little bookshop with a catchy name. He waited for a cluster of cars to pass by and crossed the street to the corner of the park. What he'd mistaken for grass was a dense, low plant with swollen leaves. It reminded him of the brown-green seaweed that washed up on the beach sometimes. He wondered what the park looked like from above. What did the points of the triangle aim at? Maybe the short paths or plants formed some kind of symbol or... The steel monument at the center of the park. From this angle, it was less of a pillar and more of a futuristic one-piece signpost. The shaft flowed up and widened into a rectangular top that reminded him of a huge highway mile marker. Eli stepped around a few bushes and got a clear view of the monument's base. His mind froze up. Once again, he was struck with the surreal sensation of being in a movie. A Muppet movie.